Hi, good afternoon, everyone. I hope you can hear me here. I want to thank you for joining us today. This is Jordan Clopton, and I have Michael Cugino, our CEO and portfolio manager, on the line as well. And this is our Q3 portfolio manager Q&A session. We really appreciate you all giving us some of your time today. It means a lot. We all know you have a lot of other things or items that are vying for your time and attention, so we appreciate you guys being on the phone with us right now. You know, it's good to see our attendance numbers for these calls creeping up each quarter. You know, there's no science to what I'm about to say. I think it's purely anecdotal and mainly driven by my own selfish desire to make myself feel better, maybe. But I think we have more advisors dialing in because our permanent portfolio fund is a little more relevant given everything we are seeing, you know, geopolitically, fiscal and monetary policy-wise, and purely from a valuation standpoint. We have no shortage of things to talk about, so I really encourage people to ask questions. Questions are the best way, obviously, to have a really great dialogue. And to that end, right now everyone is in listen-only mode. In a couple seconds, I will turn it over to Michael, and he will take over with a quick recap of Q3 and touch on some of the core issues for 2018. Once he wraps up his introduction, we will turn it over. We'll turn it over for questions. You have two ways to ask a question. There's a text box that you can type your question into, and I will read back your question, or you can click on that little hand icon, and I will unmute your line. There's always a slight delay with the audio, so give yourself a, you know, like maybe a one Mississippi count before asking your question. All right, so that's enough for me. Michael, why don't you kick things off?
Thank you, Jordan, and I'd like to thank everybody for participating, whether you're an existing investor or one that's considering an investment in one or more of our portfolios. I want to thank you for your interest, and if you're an existing investor, thank you for your confidence that you've shown in investing in our strategies. Jordan had provided a very good lead-in, and we'll get to some of those factors as to why we believe that permanent portfolio is probably more relevant going forward than it has been maybe in the last few years, and I'll touch on some of those factors in a few minutes. Just a quick kind of summary of the quarter and where we are year-to-date with respect to our portfolios before I get into that sort of analysis. Permanent portfolio continues, well, all of our portfolios continue to invest in their designated strategies. Permanent portfolio continues its strategy of, you know, broadly diversifying across asset sectors, being properly diversified all the time, and using that strategy. Year to date, it's up about 9%. For the quarter ended September 30th, returns were driven primarily by aggressive growth and natural resource equities, to a lesser extent, commodities, and bonds were roughly a break even. For the year to date performance, it's been mostly driven by equities and particularly aggressive growth or traditional growth stock names, with lesser contributions from natural resources and real estate stocks, and also precious metals like gold and silver. So gold and silver are less relevant in the third quarter than they are year to date, and I would say that trend has probably continued so far in the fourth quarter, although the recent bump in the last couple days has helped out those numbers as well. And bonds have been gradual positive performers, with Swiss bonds being our best bond performers year to date. And so we have a pretty diversified mix of investment performance across our strategy. And yet, over the longer term, I mean, certainly we've had our challenges in the last 3 to 5 years, especially the last 5 years with the sell-off in metals and the taper tantrum and some of the uncertainties relating to interest rates and the sort of cyclical bottom in commodities. So it's, in our view, there's a little bit of misconception sometimes about this portfolio. And we try to remind people what it does and what it isn't. It's not a short-term trading vehicle. It's never going to approximate an equity run in common stocks. It's something that you determine how much you need as an overall as part of an overall wealth accumulation, building, and maintenance strategy, and you allow it to be part of a broader portfolio strategy. It's an absolute return, you know, multi-asset strategy designed to perform in any market. And there's been some discussion, you know, with respect to that as well. another misconception in our fund is that it's only an inflation driver, or only performs well in inflationary environments. And when there is an inflation or when metals aren't doing anything, the portfolio doesn't perform that well. That's not supported by data. Certainly, we're impacted by all of our asset classes, gold, silver, stocks, bonds as well. I mean, they're all pieces to the puzzle. But it's a misconception to assume that any one of them is single-handedly going to drive returns. And in fact, if anybody were to care to correlate or graph our returns over long periods of time versus any one asset class, you know, say versus stocks, versus bonds, versus the price of gold, versus cash, et cetera, we're not going to correlate to any of them. We're going to be somewhere in the middle of all that, which is exactly how we're designed and exactly what we are supposed to be as an absolute return fund. So it's difficult for us sometimes when we have misconceptions about our fund. You know, it's only an inflation fund, it's only good for gold, et cetera, because they're really not true, and it's a limiting view of our fund to consider the fund only with those asset classes in mind and not look at it on its whole as a broad array of diversified assets all the time, all working together to provide a broad multi-market sort of absolute return over different environments and different economic clients and different asset classes. And so the portfolio remains one that is designed to provide multiple avenues to growth while also limiting downside risk in a number of environments. And true to form, it does not try to predict the future, and it minimizes portfolio manager risk or tactical allocation risk, those sorts of things that are more driven by my higher trading strategies. And as such, it acts as a good complement to those sorts of things if you're trying to incorporate that into a broader environment. For example, obviously, you know, given the precious metals, the exposure to commodities, growth, we expect to do well in inflationary environments, and we think we're well positioned for that going forward. But even in periods where you had it rising interest rates or deflation, the portfolio has had periods of time where it's done very well over those times as well. We've done a marketing piece that we've distributed that shows various economic conditions and how our portfolio has performed, and obviously the returns are variable, but it does clear up misconceptions. The 08 was a very deflationary time, for example, and the portfolio performed pretty well relative to just about everybody else out there. During the 05 to 07 period of sort of no inflation, no deflation kind of mix, but rising interest rates, the portfolio had a string of positive performance as well that belie the sort of conventional wisdom that's said about it. So there are periods like that all the time. And again, any short-term trading strategy is such that, you know, anomalies exist, correlations exist. They can be very short-term. You can have those sorts of things happen in markets all the time. But over longer periods, the assets, the true DNA of the assets, and the lack of correlation between them, and how they react to each other and to other, you know, economic and financial stimulus, tends to hold true to form. And I think that's true of our portfolio. So that would be permanent portfolio. Our stock fund, aggressive growth portfolio, year to date is up about 15.62%, primarily driven by, and I would say the equity performance in permanent was also driven, for the year to date by entertainment, leisure, and tech-related leisure, manufacturing, financial services, and to some degree lately a return in energy and natural resource stocks. And so aggressive growth continues to be a broad, you know, focused strategy of equities only, multi-cap, focused on, you know, 30 to 50 names with a long-term 3 to 5 year bent in terms of how we see ourselves investing, low turnover, et cetera. So it continues to maintain that strategy. Our two bond funds, versatile bond fund, through year-to-date has been up 84 basis points, and that invests in a broad array of different types of fixed income instruments. It's primarily in corporate bonds at the moment with a duration of about 3 years, and an average duration of about 3 years, an average maturity of 3.7 years, and an effective duration of 3.4 years. It is primarily, like I said, invested in corporates, and it's roughly about three quarters investment grade. So, you know, in this environment of rising interest rates, and we expect it, and I'll get into this a little bit in a second economically, but I think we're in early days of a reversal of trends in interest rates and interest rate directions. And so it makes sense to be, you know, shorter duration and higher quality balance sheets. And take advantage of rising rates and turn over investments as they mature to higher rates. So I believe we're pretty well positioned there as well. In our short-term treasury fund, you know, for the first time in several years, we have a positive return. Obviously, it's a low-risk, you know, treasuries and governments-only type of product. We're running that at an average duration of 0.6 years, so still relatively short-term. And again, it conforms to our belief that the Fed is in the middle of raising rates. We expect another one in December and probably more in you know, 18, consistent with their comments. And again, I'll get into that in a second. But the issue there is that, you know, for the first time in quite a while, we're getting returns in treasuries that exceed the cost of running the fund. And for short-term liquidity, for a place to park assets, you know, capital waiting for the next opportunity, it remains a reasonable choice. One other comment with the portfolios, for all of them, we expect to be paying dividends the first week in December. I believe the dates are December 5th or 6th as a record date. I know it's on our website, and you can confirm it there. You can also call Jordan or Dan or Patrick, Donald or Brendan, or our shareholder services offices if you want exact information. Given the changing nature and the fact that performance and investment decisions change daily, we do not have a specific number with respect to our dividends, but we do expect in all cases for our distributions, our income distributions, and our distributions, which we believe will likely be only long-term capital gains, we expect to be around historical norms. And I would say specifically with permanent portfolio, we expect the dividend, those dividends, both income and capital gain, to be consistent with periods before 2013. So for those of you that have been in our fund for a while, you know that, you know, 13 through 15, we had dividend rates that were, and distribution rates are a little bit higher than our historical norm, although for the industry, they weren't that outrageous. Last year, we had, you know, a much smaller dividend and distribution, and we expect another year of relatively, you know, dividends and distributions that are more consistent with our longer-term history than say, versus the years 13 through 15. And again, we'll have more details on that, and please feel free to call our institutional sales team or the shareholder services office for more information on that. With respect to where we see, you know, where are we right now and how we see ourselves positioned, it is an interesting time. We've had a lot of conversations with advisors lately that are getting more nervous by the day with respect to the strategies that have worked for the last few years. And at what point do you sort of get off the merry-go-round and begin to try to do something different with an expectation that change may be coming? I alluded to this in my notes in the semi-annual report that we issued in late September. But, you know, right now the stock market is doing well. It's supported by corporate earnings. It's supported by a belief in better fiscal regulatory policy to come, more CapEx spending, potentially more lending, better economic growth, et cetera. And in fact, we've had two straight quarters of GDP growth of around 3%, which is something we haven't had in a while. There's certainly no reason to go out and sell stocks in and of themselves. However, there are some factors that I think investors need to consider that make the period of time where we're at a little bit more interesting than, say, the period of the last several years. I mean, for the most part, with some changes in the middle, an investor did very, very well by simply buying, you know, stock and bond indexes and being long those indexes. Cheap capital was obtained and spent buying stocks and bonds and real estate. And for the most part, that's been where capital has been allocated. And for investors that have been long those investments, it's worked out very, very well. And in fact, running a firm that really are philosophical believers in hedging and diversification and multi-assets, it's been a time that has been difficult for us. Although we have been around since 1982 and we really believe in the long-term thinking and what we do over the long term, and we have, unlike many other strategies, we have the numbers to back it up, it's been challenging. And so the conditions that have caused that, the cheaper money, the quantitative easing, the lack of, you know, maybe aggressive business development, squeezing out every dollar of profits and earnings from low revenue growth, et cetera, all those characteristics. I can't say it's changing right now, and in fact, maybe it won't, but just maybe it will. You know, we are on the verge, or we're in the early days of an interest rate directional change, with Federal Reserve policy likely to change with the new chairman coming in, and the growth attributes that the current administration is talking about. Whether those come to pass or not, and to what degree, I think remains a very open question. But there's a philosophy of reallocating capital away from just stocks and bonds and real estate to more productive assets in the economy, the production of goods and services, et cetera. And so that is a change from what we've had. The fact that we have a directional change in interest rates already started with more to come, with more likely to come, is something that is a change. The yield curve has begun to, and this has been happening gradually for a while, but it continues, and we expect it to continue more. The yield curve is flattening. The spread between twos and tens have continued to compress, and that's true across the curve in other ways. The fact that global growth is resuming after being dormant for quite a while, and that global interest rates are beginning to rise in mass, creating a situation where, you know, up to this year, our Fed was going in one direction, even raising rates at all, while the rest of the world was in negative rates and you know, still doing quantitative easing. Well, some of those policies are still true. You can't deny the fact that the yields on global, you know, sovereign debt all over the world have begun to go back up, and economies in many parts of the world have begun to improve. That's also helped the U.S. economy, but it also means that other central banks may be directionally going the same way that our Fed is going, and to the extent that that growth picks up, accelerates, et cetera, will have impacts on our own growth rates and our own monetary policy, which has implications for the strong dollar that's been in play for the last couple of years, and how that impacts emerging markets. And so that's a factor that needs to be considered. Certainly the change in administration and policy, the focus on reducing some regulation and potentially reducing corporate tax rates, accelerating depreciation. Now, not as much done on the personal side as yet, but again, all of this is so preliminary, it's tough to game plan this day to day, and it's probably best that we don't, you know, and just wait to see what comes out of all this and then plan around it. But the fact remains that, you know, if incentives are provided to do spending in a certain way versus another way, then it's likely that that's going to follow. And I don't think it's surprising that U.S. manufacturing, industrial stocks, material stocks, those sorts of things have been good performers this year in anticipation of that. And so I think the question that you've got to ask is, well, a lot of things worked for the last several years. Are they going to work going forward? And the question is maybe, maybe not. The answer is maybe, maybe not. And like I said, I'm not saying that we'll have a sell-off in stocks per se. Just I don't believe stock runs just end because somebody says, well, it's time for the stock market to end its run. But there will be factors that will drive it. Rising interest rates are cumulative. The more you have, the more aggressive they are, the quicker in succession they come. That could have a way of potentially making the choice for investors between bond investing and stock investing that much more difficult. The risk-reward calculus for most investors is pretty easy when the cost of capital is low. When the competing yields and risk on bonds goes up, especially if you're in shorter duration and riding the curve, that decision to invest only in stocks or to have the heavy allocations you have versus bonds begins to get very interesting. Similarly, the knee-jerk reaction that as interest rates go up, gold goes down, is really just that. It's a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, it makes sense. The opportunity cost to own gold goes up when it doesn't earn interest and dividends, et cetera. That's, while that's true, the real question is, what's causing interest rates to go up? And in many cases, it's the same reasons that are causing gold to go up. So in fact, they do act much more in tandem, and they're not the sort of reverse, you know, correlation type trade that typically you might see, or the knee-jerk reaction that you typically get by investors that, you know, interest rates go up, gold goes down. In fact, we ran a study recently on this issue, and we looked at almost 30 years worth of data going back to 1987, where gold is charted versus the Fed's effective interest rates, and we noted a very low correlation. And so there is no correlation there exactly, or really a strong negative correlation. It's just a zero. Or it's a very low number. And so I think the same factors that drive interest rates, especially gradually rising interest rates, will also drive inflationary pressures, and with that, assets that are used to hedge those sorts of pressures. Not surprisingly, wage pressures are starting to build. The inflation number, while still very low, is beginning to creep up and be near the Fed's target on a more consistent basis. Unemployment remains very, very low. In fact, it's very low to the period. I saw a statistic recently that, you know, when the 2000 recession started in I guess it would have been April of 2000 or sometime in the spring of 2000, we had an unemployment rate at that time of 3.8%. I'm quoting others on this, so I don't have the data in front of me. But you know, we're not that far off in terms of unemployment from that. And so when you start looking at that, not surprisingly also, that was a period where interest rates began to go up post Y2K and the low rate environments leading into, you know, late 1999 and early 2000. So there are some things to be cautious of for investors. And while the last several years have worked very well, I believe the next several are going to be very different in terms of return expectations, in terms of what's going to work, in terms of asset classes and also volatility. Like I mentioned, we're in a rising rate environment. But also I think you have to consider the issue that we've never had this degree of liquidity to be drained out of the sort of economic system, if you will, between quantitative easing and low rates and, you know, et cetera. There's been a tremendous amount of liquidity created, not only here, but globally. It's been a little deceiving because money was plowed into stocks and bonds and real estate. It wasn't, the velocity on the liquidity created was relatively low with respect to things that would create inflationary pressures and the inflationary pressures caused by money flowing into the production of goods and services. So velocity was fairly quiet, which makes it seem on a day-to-day basis that there is no inflationary pressure. I would agree with that. However, with the change in dynamics that we're currently seeing or could see in the next few years, that may change. You could see more lending. Keep in mind the banks had no incentive to heavily lend into the economy during quantitative easing because you could earn 25 basis points by keeping on deposit with the Fed, and you had real business risk in making bad loans. And to the extent you're opening up the business environment, you're creating incentives to grow businesses, to spend on CapEx, to do business development, that could create more lending, more money flowing into the economy, more money flowing into production of goods and services, and thereby increase monetary velocity and increase inflationary pressures, maybe at a higher rate than you'd otherwise see. And that could create more volatility. It could create quicker succession or quicker periods of, you know, quicker interest rate increases or shorter periods in between those rate increases, maybe potentially higher rate increases. You could have greater competition for yield among global investors between U.S. and non-U.S. fixed income. You know, the U.S. has had a pretty cushy position the last several years where, you know, for a while we were one of the only ones that had positive yield. So you got the benefit of the United States, you know, private property rights, political system, et cetera, and you were getting positive rates versus the rest of the world that were negative rates and in more economic trouble. So to the extent you have more competition for the global fixed income investor, you know, that could put pressure on U.S. bonds as well. So there's a lot of factors to consider. And so it makes sense at this point for investors to sort of think about what's coming next. How should I be? Should I be diversified? If so, how much? And I think the period where diversification and you know, asset allocation is going to come back into play more and more. In fact, I think we're seeing it in talking to some of our investors and potential investors and investors that were with us for a while a few years ago that went on to reallocate into other things. So it is a factor to think about. And we believe we're positioned regardless. We believe that we have sufficient hedges and return capabilities to do very well in an inflationary environment. And we also believe that if it goes the other way, we have sufficient protection and hedges built in a deflationary environment, which is the way we've always been, and we still believe that we have that. So, you know, at this point, I want to open it up to questions. I want to thank everybody for their time, for their interest, for their confidence. We stand here ready to help you meet yours and your investors' goals. And we continue to seek to build, grow, and maintain wealth over the long term in a tax-efficient manner that seeks to grow at a rate greater than inflation. So we hope that that's a part of your strategy. And, you know, on that point, I think just to put a sort of final number on it, going back since 82 when we first started the fund, I mean, on an average annual total return basis, and you can see this in our data sheets, we had an inflation rate as measured by the three-month Treasury bill index of a 3.85%. So not exactly CPI, but it's a securities index that approximates, you know, risk-free Treasury securities. Our return over that time since 82, again, in all conditions, all economic environments, was 6.1. So the portfolio throughout its history, higher inflation for the first maybe third to half of its existence, lower inflation maybe the second half of its existence, has beaten inflation by 225 basis points over 35 years and counting. And so I think it's a fair question for investors to ask and for advisors to ask, you know, is there a place in a portfolio at some level that has a documented history of returning, you know, 6.1% in you know, over multiple economic scenarios and risk factors and financial climates and et cetera, versus that inflation rate? And would you take that for a portion of your portfolio as part of an overall mix of assets and mix of strategies? And I think for many people, the answer, you know, is a favorable one. And it's something to leave you with in terms of my formal comments. So thanks again. Good luck the rest of the year to everybody. And always feel free to contact us with questions, to set up conference calls. I believe part of my job is to be available. We remain a small firm, and part of that smallness is designed to be more accessible to investors and to speak with investors and advisors and explain what we're doing and why we do it. And I believe it's a significant component of who we are. So feel free to call, and thanks again.
Yeah, and before you log off, you know, everybody, feel free to ask questions. Again, you can hit the raise your hand icon or email me a quick question. So I'll see if anybody wants to ask anything. All right, we have Brad Skiles who's going. Yeah, all right, Brad, hold on a sec. Here we go. All right, Brad, you've been unmuted.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Quick question. You commented on, obviously, the low employment rate. Do you have any concerns whether the declining labor force participation rate is a better indicator of the economy than the unemployment rate?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Brad. You know, I would agree that it's a significant factor. And I also, you know, one thing I didn't touch on that is also a factor is the degree of technology, you know, evolution, if you will, and how that's impacting employment, and the age of, you know, the relative age of our workers. So, you know, technology is certainly having a huge factor in employment, and that's impacting productivity. I don't know if I'd say productivity is a better indicator or a worse one. I'll leave that to formally trained PhDs in economics. But I think that they're both significant, and you want to consider both in an assessment of where we're going. I don't think its impact is enough to change my conclusion on employment and unemployment, but it is a significant factor that maybe is causing more of an impact than it has in previous periods. I think the one thing that that remains, one thing that's related to this question is actual growth in terms of, you know, what kind of growth rates do we want this country to have, and what's the positives and negatives of whatever growth rate we decide to choose. The one negative, I guess, by having technology do more is you potentially put people out of work. And if you have a stagnant economy, or one that's, say, growing at 2% or less, for example, the ability to put those people back to work in new industries, new businesses, the incentives, the business development incentives just aren't there. I mean, think in simple terms. I mean, nobody knew they needed an iPhone until Apple went and created it. So in an economy pre-iPhone, if Apple wasn't incentivized properly to create that, you'd never even know you needed. And think of how many people, not only at Apple, but in terms of the ancillary, you know, software developers, service providers, et cetera, to that company and those apps providers. Think about the multiplier effect of that economic impact. And so I think the key thing to offset the negatives of technology improving our working lives in many areas would be to provide more incentives for us to develop new technologies, create new companies, think of things that we haven't even determined that we need to do, and throw a lot of capital at them. And it's likely that many of them will be successful and employ some of the people that are being, you know, put out of jobs by technological advances. And traditionally, that's a dynamic impact to the U.S. economy that we've seen over decades. And I think the one positive attribute, if we do get a growth package and we do get growth incentives, and they really are worthwhile and not just, you know, for political purposes, would be that you might begin to get some of that business creation. I mean, if you're taxing corporations at 20% versus 35, and, you know, similar small businesses, LLCs and whatever, at a reduced rate, then you're putting incentives in place for people to create new businesses and new technologies and new goods and services. And they'll employ some people that have been, you know, outsized at companies where technology has taken over. And so I think that rolling dynamicism of the U.S. economy is something that we want to promote. And so how it impacts the current unemployment number, I think it's significant, but I wouldn't rely on that or the unemployment number in and of itself. But I think there's a broader question with respect to employment creation and technology that also is impacted in that question.
All right, Michael, we also want to get to a question from Joe Gallimore. Joe is asking why is your real estate sector performance much better than the benchmark? Joe, if you're still there, I'll unmute your line if you want to sort of add to that question. Michael, I have up for everybody that's on the call our schedule of investments from July 31, 2017. So,
sure.
Joe, your line's unmuted.
Is Joe, you there, or is Jordan's paraphrasing sufficient? Joe's not there, so I'll address the question, Jordan. I think it's a question of sector and issuer selection, really. REITs, we've historically tried to diversify our real estate exposure over a number of different REIT subsectors and real estate sectors. And so, you know, we've had exposure in areas that have been very, very good performers. The question is, with a rising rate environment, will they continue to do so? And, it's an active area that we continue to look at, given that we made significant bets in real estate going back several years when a lot of REITs were being sold off post-financial crisis, and many of those have worked out tremendously well for us. The idea was that the proverbial baby in the bathwater were being thrown out under, you know, potential credit and balance sheet issues, and we felt that many of those were being way overdone, and we bought shares in many of them and have continued to hold them, but also trimmed into positive markets as well. Excuse me. And so things like office REITs, for example, warehousing REITs, data center REITs, we've had exposure in some of these areas that have been good performers in the REIT sector, and I think that describes, probably the reason why.
Okay, anybody else have any other questions for us? Okay, I mean, Michael, if you feel like you've touched on everything you wanted to cover today, I think that does it for
us. I'd like to thank everybody again, and good luck in the fourth quarter and year end, and thank you for your investment or your consideration of us as an investment, and feel free to contact us with any questions you have going forward. So thanks again.
Michael, thank you for the time, and thanks to everybody that joined us today. We greatly appreciate you taking time out of your day. If you need anything from us, you can always email me, Jordan@permportfunds.com, or call me directly, 617-841-2501, or Brendan Stack, or Don Conway, or Dan Vayner, or Patrick Mueller. So again, thanks everybody for the time. We greatly appreciate it. Take care. Enjoy Thanksgiving. Enjoy the holidays. And have a great end of 2017. And bye for now. Bye.